Greetings, sisters and brothers out there in Tape Land. My name is Brother Dex, and welcome to another installment of The Dex Files. On today's tape, which will be entitled, Why Do They Hate Us So Much? This will be an examination of U.S. foreign policy, globalization, and the New World Order. Basically, an examination of the exploitation of people of color and the poor. And this is going to be basically why black people, us as a whole, need to start studying public policy and U.S. foreign policy. The book that I will be using today is called The Terrorism Trap, September 11 and Beyond by Dr. Michael Parenthi. This book is about 110 pages long, and it's a very easy read, which means that it's broken down in such a way that you will understand it. The Terrorism Trap is a powerfully argued analysis of the deeper causes and meanings of September 11. Why did the attacks happen? Who is to be blamed? Who is taking advantage of the crisis? Who is hurt by all the ensuing events? Why do they hate us? Responding to such questions, Michael Parenthi probes the religious zealotry of today, Afghanistan's hidden history, and the course of U.S.-led globalization that has impoverished and angered much of the world. This acute dissection of the political, economic, and religious forces behind the attacks provides historical perspective and insight into how to prevent future terrorism and save democracy. Like I stated before, brothers and sisters, this is going to be an analysis of U.S. foreign policy and U.S.-led globalization. Also, brothers and sisters, Dr. Michael Parenthi has also written other books, such as Inventing Reality, Make-Believe Media, Democracy for the Few, and I would highly recommend that you pick up this book here, September 11 and Beyond, The Terrorism Trap. The chapter that we're going to be dissecting today is called Why U.S. Leaders Intervene Everywhere, Chapter 5. Washington policymakers claim that U.S. intervention is motivated by the desire to fight terrorism, bring democracy to other peoples, maintain peace and stability in various regions, defend our national security, protect weaker nations from aggressors, oppose tyranny, prevent genocide, and the like. But if U.S. leaders have only the best intentions when they intervene in other lands, why has the United States become the most hated nation in the terrorist pantheon of demons? And not only Muslim zealots, but people from all walks of life around the world denounce the U.S. government as the prime purveyor of violence and imperialist exploitation. Do they see something that most Americans have not been allowed to see? Supporting the right. Since World War II, the U.S. government has given some $240 billion in military aid to build up the military and internal security forces of more than 80 other nations. The purpose of this enormous effort has been not to defend these nations from the invasion by foreign aggressors, but to protect their various ruling oligarchs and multinational corporate investors from the dangers of domestic anti-capitalist insurgency. This is what some of us have been arguing, but how can we determine that? By observing that, A, with few exceptions, there is no evidence suggesting that these various regimes have ever been threatened by attack from neighboring countries. B, just about all these friendly regimes have supported economic systems that are integrated into a global system of corporate domination, open to foreign penetration on terms that they are singularly favorable to transnational investors. And C, there is a great deal of evidence that U.S.-supported military and security forces and death squads in these various countries have been repeatedly used to destroy reformist movements, labor unions, peasants' organizations, and popular insurgencies that advocate some kind of egalitarian, redistributive politics for themselves. Now, brother, we got to stop right there. When he talks about these death squads and everything, one just has to look at where they were trained at. Most of these death squads were trained here in the United States of America at a place called the Camp of the Americas, School of the Americas, down there, if I'm not mistaken, Fort Benning, Georgia. And this school has been known to train some of the most brutal regimes around the world, from, you know, terrorist regimes such as over there in Haiti, terrorist regimes from down there in South America. I'm talking about military. For decades, we were told that a huge U.S. military establishment was necessary to contain an expansionist world communist movement with its headquarters in Moscow, or sometimes Beijing. But after the overthrow of the Soviet Union and other Eastern European communist nations in 1989 and 1991, Washington made no move to dismantle its costly and dangerous global military apparatus. All Cold War weapons programs continued in full force, with new ones being added all the time, including the Outer Space National Missile Defense and other projects to militarize outer space. Now, brothers and sisters, I'm going to stop right there. I'm going to go to Covert Action Quarterly for the year 2001, number 70, and I'm going to give you some quotes from that magazine about Star Wars. And this is from page 27. Space Corps, the dangerous business of making the heavens a war zone. And this is by Carl Grossman. The Bush-Cheney White House has close links to corporate Star Warriors, and an arms race in space could be the costly consequence. And this is a quotation from page 27. The globalization of the world economy will continue with a widening between the haves and have-nots, says the U.S. Space Command. By controlling space and the earth below, the U.S. will be able to keep those have-nots in line. This is another quotation, brothers and sisters, from page 30 of the same article. The Bush-Cheney administration has a foreign policy platform written by a top executive of Lockheed Martin, a kingpin in U.S. space warfare operations. Cheney was a member of the TRW board. His wife was a member of the Lockheed Martin board. This is another quotation, brothers and sisters. Vision for 2020 proclaims the U.S. Space Command's mission, dominating the space dimension of military operations to protect U.S. interests and investment. Now, brothers and sisters, one thing that you must remember, when they talk about U.S. investments, if you ever hear it on the news, they're talking about these multinational corporations and globalization in other countries of color and poor countries, basically getting the natural resources, exploiting labor, paying them little or nothing. And a lot of brothers and sisters be asking me this question here, well, why should I worry about globalization? This is one reason why. Because this is the best reason why. Because jobs will leave the United States of America, bottom line. Now we go back to the terrorism trap, September 11th and beyond. Page 75. Washington made no move to dismantle its costly, dangerous global military apparatus. All Cold War weapons programs continued in full force, with new ones being added all the time, including the Outer Space National Missile Defense and other projects to militarize space. Immediately, the White House and Pentagon began issuing gerunds about a whole host of new enemies, for some explained reason previously overlooked, who menaced the United States, including dangerous rogue states like Libya with its ragtag army of 50,000, and North Korea with its economy on the brink of collapse. The real intentions of U.S. national security state leaders can be revealed in part by noting whom they assist and whom they attack. U.S. leaders have constantly supported rightist regimes and organizations and opposed leftist ones. The terms right and left are seldom specifically defined by policymakers or media commentators, and with good reason. To explicate the political economic content of leftist governments and movements is to reveal their egalitarian and usually democratic goals, making it much harder to demonize them. The left, as I would define it, encompasses those individuals, organizations, and governments that oppose the privileged interests of wealthy property class, while advocating egalitarian redistributive policies and a common development beneficial to the general populace. You're right. Now, brothers and sisters, when he talks about egalitarianism, or egalitarian. That's a word that means to be equal, to be fair, to distribute everything fairly. Now, page 76. The right, too, is involved in redistributive politics, but the distribution goes the other way, in an upward direction. Rightist governments and groups, including fascist ones, are dedicated to using the land, labor, markets, and natural resources of countries as so much fodder for the enrichment of the owning and investing classes. In almost every country, including our own, rightist groups, parties, or governments pursue tax and spending programs, wage and investment practices, methods of police and military control, and deregulation and privatization policies that primarily benefit those who receive the bulk of their income from investments and property at the expense of those who live off wages, salaries, fees, and pensions. And it, you know, basically, brothers and sisters, what he's saying here is basically off us. Basically, Reaganomics, the trickle-down effect. The rich get richer, the poor get poorer. That is what's defined and distinguishes the right from the left. Another thing is, too, brothers and sisters, if we go back to page 75 when he's talking about the Cold War and he's talking about those military weapons, where did those military weapons go to? Now, some of those older military weapons went to your SWAT teams or your special response teams here in this country. Like M16s, riot shotguns, different types of ammunition, night vision goggles, you name it. The police departments, county sheriffs, they all have all this stuff. Kevlar helmets, you name it. In just about every instance, rightist forces are deemed by U.S. opinion makers to be friendly to the West, a coded term for pro-capitalist. And by the way, when they talk about the West, what they're talking about is European governments, or basically Caucasians or white folks. Conversely, leftist ones are labeled as anti-democratic, anti-American, and anti-West, when actually what they are against is global capitalism. While claiming to be motivated by a dedication to human rights and democracy, U.S. leaders have supported some of the most notorious right-wing autocracies in history, governments that have tortured, killed, or otherwise maltreated large numbers of their citizens because of their dissenting political views, as in Turkey, Zaire, Chad, Pakistan, Morocco, Indonesia, Honduras, Peru, Colombia, Argentina, El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, the Philippines, Cuba under Batista, Nicaragua under Somoza, Iran under the Shah, and Portugal under Salazar. Now, that's what I was telling you about, brothers and sisters, before, is that a lot of these countries used to send their military leaders over here to learn how to be more brutal to the school of the Americas. And I talked about that earlier. Washington also assists counter-revolutionary groups that have perpetuated some of the most brutal bloodletting against civilian populations in leftist countries. Junta in Angola, Renamo in Mozambique, the Contras in Nicaragua, the Khmer Rouge during the 1980s in Cambodia, the Mujahideen and then the Taliban in Afghanistan, and the right-wing drug-dealing KLA terrorists in Kosovo. All this is a matter of public record, although seldom if ever treated in the U.S. media. And by the way, brothers and sisters, you can go to the Freedom of Information Act, the FIOA, the Freedom of Information Act, and it, you know, a lot of the documents have been declassified. And by the way, the KLA, it stands for the Kosovo Liberation Army. Washington's support has extended to the extreme rightist reach of the political spectrum. Thus, after World War II, U.S. leaders and their Western capitalist allies did nothing to eradicate fascism from Europe, except for prosecuting some top Nazi leaders at Nuremberg. In short time, former Nazis and their collaborators were back in the saddle in Germany. Hundreds of Nazi war criminals found a haven in the United States and Latin America, either living in comfortable anonymity or employed by U.S. intelligence agencies during the Cold War. Now, we got to start right there, brothers and sisters. Some of these same scientists that were in the Nazi regime under Hitler became part of the CIA. And some of those same Nazi scientists, you know, with their research and mind control, namely, or i.e., MK Ultra. And basically, this is what's going on today. Some of these same Nazi scientists, the techniques that they used over there in Nazi-occupied Germany are being used today. Page 78. In France, very few Vichy collaborators were purged. And I quote, no one of any rank was seriously punished for his or her role in the roundup and deportation of Jews to Nazi camps. U.S. military authorities also restored fascist collaborators to power in various Far East nations. In South Korea, police trained by the fascist Japanese occupation force were used after the war to suppress left democratic forces. The South Korean army was commanded by officers who had served in the Imperial Japanese Army, some of whom who had been guilty of horrid war crimes in the Philippines and China. In Italy, within a year after the war, almost all Italian fascists were released from prison, while hundreds of communists and other leftist partisans who had been valiantly fighting the Nazi occupation were jailed. Allied authorities initiated most of these measures. In the 3 decades after the war, U.S. government agencies gave an estimated $75 million to right-wing organizations in Italy. From 1969 to 1974, high-ranking elements in Italian military and civilian intelligence agencies, along with various secret and highly placed neo-fascist groups, embarked upon a campaign of terror and sabotage known as the Strategy of Tension, involving a series of kidnappings, assassinations, and bombing massacres directed against the growing popularity of the democratic preliminary left, parliamentary left, excuse me. In 1995, a deeply implicated CIA refused to cooperate with an Italian parliamentary commission investigating this terrorist campaign. In the 1980s, scores of people were murdered in Germany, Belgium, and elsewhere in Western Europe by right-wing terrorists in the service of state security agencies. As with the earlier Strategy of Tension in Italy, the attacks attempted to create enough popular fear and uncertainty to undermine the existing social democracies. The U.S. corporate-owned media largely ignores these events. Now, brothers and sisters, one thing that we need to talk about right here also, we can look at what went on during the years of apartheid over there in South Africa and how corporations here in this country invested in South Africa. And then also we can look at how a lot of the Western countries, the white European countries, supported the South African regime, the South African apartheid regime, such as England, the United States, Italy, and a few others, how they basically supported apartheid, attacking the left. We can grasp the real intentions of U.S. leaders by looking at who they target for attack. Specifically, just about all leftist governments, movements, and popular insurgencies. Now, brothers, we also can stop right here. We can look at what happened to all the leaders, the real black leaders back in the 60s and 70s, and organizations from the 60s and 70s. We can look at what happened to SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Nation of Islam. We can also look at what happened to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. We can look at what happened to Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, just to name a few. They were all destroyed in the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. Can't forget them. Of how the federal government used torture, provocateurish activities, and assassination to quiet and to destroy a lot of these groups under the counterintelligence program. And basically a lot of the same things that they did to these groups is some of the same things that they did over in other countries. Like over there in Italy, over there in Greece, you name it, they've done it. Over in Africa, you name it. The methods used include financing, infiltrating, and co-opting their military and their internal security units and intelligence agencies, providing them with police state technology, including instruction, instruments of torture. B, imposing crippling economic sanctions and IMF austerity programs, bribing political leaders, military leaders, and other key players. Ooh. D, inciting retrograde ethnic separatist and supremacist within the country. E, subverting their democratic and popular organizations. F, rigging their elections. And G, financing collaborative political parties, labor unions, academic researchers, journalists, religious groups, non-governmental organizations, and various media. And like I say, bro, since these are some of the the methods that the CIA has used around the world to destabilize and take over governments around this planet. And like I stated before, most of the countries that they have taken over are countries with either one, natural resources, such as over there in Africa and so-called Middle East, countries with high populations, such as over there in Asia, like over there in Korea, China, you name it. U.S. leaders profess a dedication to democracy, yet over the past five decades, dramatically, democratically elected reformist governments guilty of introducing egalitarian redistributive economic programs in Guatemala, Guyana, the Dominican Republic, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Syria, Indonesia under Sukarno, Greece, Cyprus, Argentina, Bolivia, Haiti, the Congo, and numerous other nations were overthrown by their respective military forces funded and advised by the U.S. national security state. The intent behind Washington's policy is seen in what the U.S.-sponsored military rulers do when they come to power. They roll back any reforms and open their countries all the wider to foreign corporate investors on terms completely favorable to the investors. And, brothers and sisters, this is what you call imperialism. And at the back of this chapter, well, actually, at the end of the book, in footnotes, he talks about imperialism. Imperialism is a term not normally applied by mainstream commentators and academics to anything that U.S. leaders do, so perhaps it needs a definition. Imperialism, as used here, is the process whereby the ruler of one country uses economic and military power to exploit the land, labor, markets, and natural resources of another country in order to attain even greater capital accumulations on behalf of wealthy interests at home and abroad. So basically, brothers and sisters, with this globalization, it's exploiting people on two fronts. Basically, in the countries where they have taken over the natural resources and they have exploited the people, and then over in this country where people lose their jobs and they're spending more money for basic necessities or paying more for like a car. But nowadays, when you buy a car and you have to get it worked on, the parts are coming from overseas. Or either we can look at with the gym shoes, Nike, a good example. Now, they only paying those people like 30 cents per day or 30 cents per hour to make a pair of gym shoes that's $150, $160. That's one other example. Let's see. The intent behind Washington's policy is seen and what the U.S.-sponsored military rulers do. Okay, we read that. The U.S. national security state has participated in covert actions or proxy military wars, mercenary wars against reformist or revolutionary governments in Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Portugal, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, Egypt, Cambodia, Lebanon, Peru, Iran, Syria, Jamaica, South Yemen, the Fiji Islands, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. Now, brothers and sisters, what do all these countries have in common? Two things. They have the natural resources, and they have the people. Like I stated before, with the natural resources, I mean, that's self-explanatory. Like I stated before, we can look at what's going on over there in Africa and over there in the so-called Middle East, Northeast Africa. And we can also look at, like I stated before, of how they are taking these natural resources out of Africa and taking them to other countries to create finished products. In many cases, the attacks were terroristic in kind. Terroristic in kind, which means that like the harassment of the people and the murder of the people was, you know, it was terrorism, plain and simple. That's the only way I can explain it. Directed at soft targets such as schools, farm cooperatives, health clinics, and whole villages. These wars of attrition extracted a grisly toll on human life and frequently forced the reformist or revolutionary government to discard its program and submit to IMF dictates, after which the U.S. propelled terrorist attacks ceased. Basically, brothers and sisters, what they did was the same thing that Al Capone used to do back in the day. Strong arm tactics. And the IMF stands for the International Monetary Fund. And basically, with the International Monetary Fund, they basically go in and set up these programs, and then when the people or these countries cannot pay back the loans, the outrageous loans, then they come in and take the land or take the natural resources and exploit the people. That's the easiest way to break it down. Since World War II, U.S. forces have invaded or launched aerial assaults against Vietnam, Laos, the Dominican Republic, North Korea, Cambodia, Lebanon, Grenada, Panama, Libya, Iraq, speaking that, you know, Iraq, Somalia, Yugoslavia, and most recently, Afghanistan. A record of direct military aggression unmatched by any communist government in history. The U.S. and NATO forces delivered round-the-clock terror bombings on Yugoslavia for 2.5 months in 1999, targeting housing projects, private homes, hospitals, schools, state-owned factories, radio and television stations, government-owned hospitals, municipal power stations, water supply systems, and bridges, along with hundreds of other non-military targets, at great loss to civilian life. In some instances, neo-imperialism has been replaced with old-fashioned direct colonist occupation, as in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Macedonia, where U.S. troops are stationed, and more recently, in Afghanistan. And, no, you know, another thing is, too, brothers and sisters, when they talk about the neo-imperialist or the neo-colonialist, basically what they're saying is they have propped up somebody that looks just like the people to dictate to the people what the U.S. wants to be done or the corporate interest says needs to be done. Well, y'all motherfuckers ain't, or, you know, y'all folks ain't producing enough over there. Then y'all need to do it, or we gonna, you know, strong arm y'all some more. In 2000-2001, U.S. leaders were involved in a counterinsurgency war against the leftist guerrillas movement in Colombia. They also were preparing the public for moves against Venezuela, whose president, Hugo Chavez, is engaged in developing a popular movement and reforms that follow the poor. Stories appearing in the U.S. press tell us that Chavez is emotionally unstable, autocratic, and bringing his country to ruin. The same kind of media hit pieces that demonize the Sandinistas and Nicaragua, the New Jewel movement in Grenada, Allende in Chile, Noriega in Panama, Gaddafi in Libya, Milosevic in Yugoslavia, and Aristide in Haiti, to name some of the countries that were subsequently attacked by U.S. forces or surrogate military units. Governments that strive for any kind of economic independence or apply some significant portion of their budget to the not-for-profit public services are the ones most likely to feel the wrath of U.S. intervention. The designated enemy can be a populist military government, as in Panama under Omar Torrijos and under Manuel Noriega, Egypt under Gamal Abdel Nasser, Peru under Juan Velasco, Portugal under the leftist military officers of the MFA, and Venezuela under Hugo Chavez. B, a Christian socialist government, as in Nicaragua under the Sandinistas. C, a social democracy, as in Chile under Salvador Allende. Jamaica under Michael Manley, Greece under Andreas Papandreou, Cyprus under Mikhail Makarios, and the Dominican Republic under Juan Bosch. D, an anti-columnist reform government, as in the Congo under Patrice Lumumba. Now, brother, we'll stop right there. A fascinating book to check out is called The Judas Factor, The Plot to Assassinate Malcolm X. And they talk about in that book of how Patrice Lumumba was assassinated by the United States government, or elements of the United States government and British intelligence. An Islamic revolutionary order, as in Libya under Omar Gaddafi, or even a conservative militarist regime, as in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, if it should attempt an independent course on oil quotas and national development. The goal of U.S. global policy is the third worldization of the entire world, including Europe and North America. And brothers and sisters, what he means there by the third worldization is basically the exploitation of paying people lesser money, you know, for the services that they provide to these big corporations. And but, you know, one of the things that you got to remember is this, too, that it's a pretty, you know, smart business move. But thing of it is, more people are working harder and harder for lesser and less money. That's one thing that you must think about also. That's another thing about this globalization and this in the public policies. And if time permits, I'm going to get into a black directive action, a policy that was set forth by the federal, a public policy that was set forth by the U.S. government back in the 70s under the Carter administration. A world in which capital rules supreme with no labor unions to speak of. No prosperous, literate, well-organized working class with rising expectations, no pension funds or medical plans or environmental, consumer, and occupational protections or any of the other insufferable things that cut into profits. And that's what he means by the third worldization of Europe and North America. And like I say, the main people that are being exploited are basically the people of color, mainly black folks, and people that are on welfare or public assistance. While described as anti-West and anti-American, just about all leftist governments from Cuba to Vietnam to the late Soviet Union have made friendly overtures and shown a willingness to establish normal diplomatic and economic relations with the United States. It was not their hostility towards the United States that caused conflict, but Washington's intolerance of the alternative class system they represented. Now, brothers and sisters, one of the things that you must ask about Cuba is this. Who benefited before Castro, who benefited from, you know, in Cuba before Castro came into power? Answer, the white Cubans. And basically, if you look at all these other countries where these reforms were trying to be set up, basically what had happened was it was going to be egalitarian, the equal distribution of the land. But these Europeans said, no, we're not going to have that. We got to have either white folks on top or Europeans in drag on top. Talking about niggas that have been educated in white universities, such as your Rhodes Scholars, to learn how to do things the European way or the European way. In the post-World War II era, U.S. policymakers sent assistance to third world nations and put forth a Marshall Plan, grudgingly accepting reforms that produced marginal benefits for the working classes of the Western Europe and elsewhere. They did this because of the Cold War competition with the Soviet Union and the strong showing of communist parties in Western European countries. But today, there is no competing lure, hence third world peoples and working populations everywhere are given little consideration in the ongoing campaigns to roll back the political, economic, democratic gains won by working peoples in various countries. After the counter-revolution, one can judge the intentions of policymakers by the policies they pursue in countries that have been successfully drawn back into the Western orbit. Consider Grenada. In 1983, U.S. forces invaded the tiny and relatively defenseless sovereign nation of Grenada, population 110,000, in blatant violation of international law. The Reagan administration justified the assault by claiming it was a rescue operation on behalf of American students whose safety was being threatened at the St. George Medical School. The White House also asserted that the New Jewel revolutionary government had allowed the island to become a Soviet-Cuban training camp, harboring a large contingent of Cuban troops and deadly armaments to export terror and undermine democracy. It was further charged that the New Jewel movement government was planning to build a Soviet submarine base and Soviet military air base that would use Grenada to control crucial choke points along oil tanker lanes that came to the United States, thereby bringing us to our knees. When these charges proved to be without foundation, some critics concluded that White House policy toward Grenada therefore had been unduly alarmist and misguided. But the fact that officials offer alarmist and misleading rationales is no reason to conclude ipso facto that they are themselves misled. It may be that they have other motives which they prefer not to enunciate. Under the Grenadian Revolutionary Government, free milk and other foodstuffs were being distributed to the needy, as were materials for home improvement. Grade school and secondary education were free for everyone for the first time. Free health clinics were opened in the countryside, thanks mostly to assistance rendered by Cuban doctors. And by the way, brothers and sisters, Cuba will let anyone come to their country to become a doctor. And the only thing that you have to do is go back to a poor, to a community that's less fortunate in order to practice your skills as a doctor. And as a matter of fact, a brother who was into community service told me that. I wish I would have found that out about 10 years ago after I got out the United States military, out the Army, as a medical specialist. Measures were taken in support of equal pay and legal status for women. Unused land was leased to establish farm cooperatives and turned agriculture away from cash crop exports and more towards self-sufficient food production. The U.S. invasion and occupation put an end to almost all these programs. Under U.S. hegemony, unemployment in Grenada reached new heights and poverty new depths. Domestic cooperatives were suppressed or starved out. Farm families were displaced to make way for golf courses and other corporate-controlled tourist industry boomed. Grenada was once more firmly bound by the privatized free market world, once again safely third worldized. The same process occurred after the U.S. invaded Panama in December 1989. Supposedly to bring Manuel Noriega, described as a drug-dealing dictator, to justice. With Noriega and his leftist military disposed and the U.S. military firmly in control, conditions in Panama deteriorated sharply. Unemployment, already high because of U.S. embargo, climbed to 35% as drastic layoffs were imposed on the public sector. U.S. occupation authorities eliminated pension rights and other work benefits, ended public sector subsidies, privatized public services, shut down publicly owned media, jailed a number of Panamanian editors and reporters critical of the invasion. Now, brothers and sisters, a good tape to check out is called The Panama Invasion. And this tape breaks it down about what actually happened down there in Panama, the reason why the Bush administration went down there and basically took over Panama. And by the way, I do have that tape, and I'm thinking about trying to set up a showing of that tape to show you the similarities of what went on then down in 1989 in Panama and what's going on now, not just in Panama or Haiti, but also here in the United States of America with the militarization of the police. The U.S. military arrested labor union leaders and removed some 150 local labor leaders from their elected positions within their unions. Crime, poverty, drug trafficking, and homelessness increased dramatically. Free market third worldization was firmly reinstated in Panama under the banner of democracy. The same reactionary pattern was discernible in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. For decades, we were told by U.S. leaders, media commentators, and academic policy experts that the Cold War was a struggle against an expansionist world communism, with nothing said about the expansionist interest of the West of world capitalism. And by the way, brothers and sisters, the whole thing of the Cold War was basically nothing but, between the Soviet Union and the United States, was nothing but a big old experiment in white world, you know, white world domination. Basically, send in the Soviets and their program of communism, their form of communism, to oppress the people. Then here comes the United States riding in on its white horse to so-called save the people. But as I'm reading here, it's nothing but a big old, you know, it was nothing but a big old scam. But immediately after communism was overthrown in the USSR in 1991, U.S. leaders began intimating that there was something more on their agenda than just elections for the former captive nations, merely free markets. Getting rid of communism, it became clear, meant getting rid of public ownership of the means of production. Of what was used was political democracy, they seemed to be saying. If it allowed the retention of an economy that was socialistic or even social democratic, so the kind of politely seemed to weigh less than the kind of economy. The goal was and continues to be totally privatized economies that favor rich investors' interest at the expense of the people in these countries. And Brussels, a good example is too in the United States. We can look at all these big old football, baseball, basketball stadiums being put up in all these major cities. Who is benefiting from this? Namely, the owners. Because the players, they're not going to benefit. The reason why I say they're not going to benefit is because, basically, they're nothing but high-paid slaves. And basically, when I'm talking about these big old stadiums and everything, who puts the bill for them? Definitely not the owners. It is the masses of the people through their taxes. That's just one example. When words speak louder than actions, it should not go unnoticed that U.S. leaders occasionally do verbalize their dedication to making the world safe for the transnational corporate system. At such times, words seem to speak louder than actions, for the words are an admission of the real intention behind the action. For example, as President Woodrow Wilson contemplated sending U.S. troops as part of the expeditionary force of Western nations to overthrow the newly installed revolutionary socialist government in Russia in 1917, his Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, recorded in a confidential memorandum that administration's class concerns. Lansing ignored all the blather that U.S. leaders were publicly mouthing about Lenin and the Bolsheviks being German agents. Instead, he perceived them to be revolutionary socialists who sought, and I'm quoting here, to make the ignorant and incapable masses of humanity dominate the earth. The Bolsheviks wanted to overthrow all existing governments and establish on the ruins a despotism of the proletariat in every country. Now, proletariat means, brothers and sisters, a laboring class. That's what that word means. It's proletariat. Proletariat. Their appeal was to a class which does not have property but hopes to attain a share by process of the government rather than by individual enterprise. This, of course, a direct threat at existing social order, i.e. capitalism, in all countries. The danger was that it may well appeal to the average man who will not perceive the fundamental errors. And by the way, brothers and sisters, this whole thing about capitalism and communism, the capitalists were the ones that set up communism. And that's another tape within itself. Almost four decades later, in 1953, President Dwight Eisenhower uttered a forbidden truth in his State of the Union message. And I quote, "A serious and explicit purpose of our foreign policy is the encouragement of a hospitable climate for private investment in foreign nations." In 1982, the elder George Bush, then vice president in the Reagan administration, announced, "We want to maintain a favorable climate for foreign investment in the Caribbean region, not merely to protect the existing U.S. investment there, but to encourage new investment opportunities in stable, democratic, free market-oriented countries close to our shores." Not only close to our shores, but everywhere else. As General Gray, Commandant of the U.S. Marines, observed in 1990, saying that the United States must have unimpeded access to established and developing economic markets throughout the world. Now, brothers, there's one thing, too, that you must also analyze and study is this. All these folks that are higher up in the militaries, like your three- and four-star generals, and folks that are like, for these big corporations, they all in these organizations like the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberger Group, the Council on Foreign Relations, you name it.